appearances. It's, I think, the reverse, and that is a disclosure to the lender that, look, there will always be two beds, essentially, for rotation purposes and just, you know, the regular functioning of this kind of facility in terms of transition, individuals coming in and out of the facility as residents. Essentially, two beds will be vacant at all times. So there, I don't understand it to be a lender insistence that there not be more individuals.
Also, the state requires for a majority of these facilities that the facility owners allow their facility to accommodate Medicare, state pay residents, as opposed to limiting only private pay residents in their facility, which this owner has owned and operates several of these facilities, and they welcome all kinds of residents, private pay or state pay. So I think that also has to do with, there has to be for this facility two beds that are open for that type of accommodation.
So you will take Medicare or private pay?
Yes.
So you could go up to 39? Medicare.
Yes.
And then my other question, Mr. Cutler, you mentioned there would be, I think it was mature arborvitae.
Arborvitae, yeah.
Planted along the, the south and north sides. So how tall is mature?
I think the requirement is they have to be planted at 12 feet tall and be able to mature to 18 feet tall.
Planted at 12 feet?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, but that's what the condition of approval required, actually.
Yes.
Typically only, what, I think it's 6 feet or something? They can be young.
Well, they need to be planted at 12 feet in height.
In this project.
Yes.
But the code otherwise does not require anywhere near 12-foot arborvitae to be installed.
Okay, so I'm just... The condition is that you have to start with a 12-foot tall arborvitae.
And the minimum requirement would have been to provide, just a continuous landscape screen along the perimeter of the facility and either a large tree every 30 feet or a medium tree every 22 feet or a small tree every 18 feet. And we've provided the mature arborvitae as well as the tree every 22 feet along the property's perimeter.
And my final question is, I realize you have 24 hours staffing, but I'm just curious, how many jobs are we talking about roughly in this facility? Not counting the owners, let's say. Don't count the owners.
I don't know the exact numbers, but it's, I believe it's somewhere around 15 jobs, probably, maybe, between 10 and 15 jobs. I'm not really 100% sure. But during the day, day shift and swing shift, they have the most requirement for staff. And for a facility this size, I imagine it's probably at least, 5 to 8 people per shift.
Thank you.
And I just have one more follow-up question. Why do you need an adjustment on the size of the parking space, the loading space?
The standard A loading space is for your typical 18-wheeler delivery truck, which for a facility like this where they keep supplies, fresh food, and everything on site regularly, all that could be accomplished through a standard box van or a smaller delivery vehicle. We didn't need to bring in a huge 40-foot trailer or parking space for a truck that size. And I think that the smaller loading space is more than sufficient, as supplies are always stocked all the time. There isn't a huge delivery and then it doesn't come again for a while. It's continuously stocked, and that could be accomplished through a smaller vehicle.
You could have food preparation for 50 people a day and medical supplies for 50 people a day. Seems like a lot of small truck traffic if you're not going to be getting 1 week's supply in at a time.
Well, I think the delivery, the supply and food delivery service that they use also, that they're currently using on some of their other facilities, the vehicle that comes is not, does not require a space that large. It's a smaller vehicle.
So do they have other, how big are their other facilities?
One of them is, I believe, 52 beds. They have several that are, not several, but a couple other ones that are 15 beds, and one of them that's the 52, I believe 50 beds or 52 beds.
And just in case that wasn't clear in terms of the adjustment, usually in an adjustment you're trying to exceed the standard and or, you know, or bend the standard because it wouldn't fit quite. But in this instance, it's actually asking for a smaller loading dock, essentially, because a larger one isn't needed. So it's actually going the other, less intensive, because it's a less intensive use than would otherwise, you know, be expected in this larger facility.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wish to testify on behalf of the opponents?
No one else signed up.
All right, then we're back to the 5 minutes.
This appeal, again, is not about keeping something from a neighborhood or just another NIMBY argument. It's about much more. It is also not about the appearance or size of what's being built. It's not. It's also about this particular type of institution not being allowed conditional use in this particular zone. We've shown three specific code requirements that prove this 39-bed group living facility is simply not allowed in an R7 single-family zone. But we also have provided you information that our area of East Portland has accepted 75% of the Multnomah County licensed adult care homes in the city of Portland. What I think the pattern is exactly what the state and the county and the federal government are attempting to get us to move toward. The key difference here is why public policy and even city code definitions have specifically changed to define adult care homes to be the method of choice to build in the best possible living conditions for the most powerless people who live in our city. This movement's been fully adopted by the state of Oregon and Multnomah County and is becoming ever more vigilant about adult care homes it licenses in order to assure quality of life for those who lack a personal or social network to help them deal with physical limitations beyond their own control. The movement away from large institutions such as nursing homes and into smaller, more personal settings is an attempt to find caring property owners in a single-family residential zones who offer their homes to unrelated adults needing that extra level of care. It's obvious that the approach is widely accepted and that Centennial has proven that by having the second largest number of adult care homes in the entire city. The proposal today is for a group living facility that not only does not belong in the SFR 7 zone, but for the reasons stated above, it also repudiates the effort to move away from such large, unregulated facilities. 39 residential beds is arguably the least served part of the city with deficient transportation and no nearby amenities, such as safe pedestrian ways, transit access, parks, shopping, medical services, and small commercial areas, seems to indicate little, if any, possibility for the quality of life we should expect as a resident of the city. Even had the code been met by this proposal, the question that is raised by the proposed group living facility is the most important for this council to answer. There are no conditional approval conditions of approval placed on this proposal. There is nothing to guarantee the staffing that's needed for this facility. There is nothing to guarantee the physical design and amenities for this facility. There is nothing to differentiate between private and public funded residents. publicly funded residents will carry those stipulations for how they can be treated with them. People who are just moving into this facility on their own Social Security check or whatever small means of unregulated income they have none of those guarantees because of the way this institution is being defined. If this were a group home, that lack of regulation is presumed to provide a lot less risk than if you have a 39-bed institution with inadequate staffing. The point of this is not about who is doing this. The ACE family have many of these, both group homes and larger institutions, and they do that as family. That's their corporation is called that. When this proposal was brought and the appeal was brought before the hearings officer, there was no stipulation about anything more than one resident, one staff member, one person from the family being in this home. This appeal is more than the specific language in the code and how to use it. It is much more about how the code supports the premise that every resident of the city deserves the best quality of life possible, regardless of whether they are low income, elderly, disabled, or personally isolated from a support system of their own. It is not about the applicant or their proposed facility. It's about a much broader way of looking at this.
Bonnie, I know you're running out of time. May I jump in and ask you a question?
Yes.
I guess you agree that if it's a group home, it's as of right, and that would be up to, I guess...
That's what the code says.
Five beds.
Mm-hmm.
And what I guess, and you've been, you know, as usual, you've been very articulate and you've been very rigorous in framing your argument to the code. But I think where I need some help is when I look at the decision of the hearings officer at pages 4 and 5, he specifically takes the definition in the code 33.920.100 of a group living use facility and then does an analysis. And what's helpful for me to just better understand is the extent to which you disagree with his analysis where he marries the facts and the code, or where you are seeking to sort of plant a flag for us for potentially doing some changes to the code, which you think would provide better protections both for residents and for the community. And because I want to make sure that, I mean, this, as has been noted, this is not the right forum for us to necessarily make changes to the code. But I understand that you have some strong views about what the code should look like, but what's less clear to me is whether... you're able to establish that the hearing officer's analysis at page 4 and 5 fails to follow the code.
Yes, and I think it stems from the fact that the premise of the reviewer in the first place was that group living, as shown in the residential uses, is not defined in Title 33, and that's true. But if you think about it, defining group living to cover all the kinds of group living would not be a definition that could fit. If group living is not covered in the code, the normal practice is to go to a general definition of group living. And of course, that would take any kind of group living in, whether or not it was an apartment house would still be group living. So when they left the code to go define group living, I believe the hearings officer said, since you have not been specific enough in this code to say what group living in an R7 zone is, we'll go to this broader definition of any group that's living together. Now, secondly, the safeguard against that, though, Commissioner, is that if you look at the institutional uses, which are conditional uses and are group living uses, this is not among them.
Well, again, I applaud you for putting us to our proofs here, making sure that we go through this carefully. And I ask these questions out of a sincere desire to understand the argument, not to quarrel with you. But again, what I see on page 5 of the decision is 33.920.100 A states that group living may include the state definition of residential facility, and then goes on to define residential facility also includes state definition, and that defines a residential care facility, blah, blah, blah. So it appears that it contemplated that it would cross-reference to a broader category. Again, I can understand why through a legislative process or through a that you may want us to revisit this to provide greater clarity or narrow the scope or broaden the scope or whatever you think at the time. But it's not, I'm struggling with how this decision is not, in your view, grounded in the applicable code.
Well, I think the problem is the way it came through the door. It came through as if it were not a conditional use, because it couldn't come through as a conditional use. It's not an institution that's allowed in this zone, in the document, in the code document itself. Had it been state-sanctioned or even federally funded, it would have carried certain stipulations with it, as it did in 33, whatever it is, 229, about senior and disabled housing. There are requirements under that part of the code that says what it has to be before it can be allowed. There's a disconnect among those various definitions. So the reason those definitions aren't here is almost a cross-reference problem. If this were a state, if this facility of 39 people were going to carry state funding with it, or Department of Human Resources funding with it, or even disability funding with it, it would require certain things be present. But that isn't what this facility is defined to serve. This facility is not defined to serve, clearly not defined to serve, any particular group of people. So there is no protection for the people who would be living in this facility that any of the things you heard verbally here would be met. That comes with the money. That comes with the revenue source for the people who live in this facility.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Is that?
No, I'm listening very carefully and trying to sort it out. So thank you.
So I guess, Bonnie, just to follow up on this conversation, I mean, I believe the applicant said it's received its license from the state for this facility, that it's taking Medicare, private pay, Medicaid, all of which, to my knowledge, have certain standard of care attached.
Absolutely.
To this.
Yeah. But that is not a condition of approval for this proposal. That's what I'm saying. There is no required staffing, no required facility, no required structure, no required elevators, no required recreation opportunity, nothing. There is simply there's setback requirements and landscaping.
Bonnie, just with all due respect, if it is otherwise regulated by another level of government, if that became part of our conditional use process, doesn't that put us into an area that's well beyond the scope of our expertise and authority to opine on? If indeed, I mean, there's lots of things that go on in all kinds of commercial and residential dwelling that we don't primarily regulate or set the regulation.
That's exactly the point.
Okay.
It's exactly the point, because this has come in as if it were just another house with a family living in it, in which they can't tell you about your bathrooms. They can't tell you about the fact that grandma may need 24-hour care. This is not that. What I'm suggesting is if one of the conditions of approval had been to meet those requirements that are imposed by the other type of client group coming to this facility, it wouldn't have been a problem. But those conditions of approval have not been set. And we weren't in a position to, we brought up the issue about not knowing what was going on in this 39-bed facility, but we weren't in a position to add the conditions of approval.
Mayor Adams, would it be appropriate at this time to recall staff, just to have staff weigh in on this issue?
Yeah, and actually, if you don't mind, yes, so thank you.
Thank you,
Ms. McKnight. And Ms. Beaumont, you've heard the testimony and the good questions from council. from your job is to give us, in addition to the bureau staff, is to give us legal advice. Do you have any observations?
I do. While I understand Ms. McKnight's concerns, I think those concerns and testimony really are running afield of the zoning code. What the zoning code criteria focus on are the externalities, what the use looks like, how it meets the land use criteria that have been set forth in the zones in terms of setback height and physical features. It doesn't focus on sort of funding or operational aspects of it. And I think were the council to try to impose a condition of approval related to funding or operation of this facility, it really would be inconsistent with the approval criteria that are set out in the code.
Could we ask our able staff person to give us some guidance based on the exchange that you've heard?
Absolutely. And I probably, I apologize, I should have put a little bit more emphasis in my opening presentation to you when I talked about the elderly and disabled chapter, how that doesn't apply, but the group living chapter does. And I know you folks are very familiar with the zoning code and the definitions. Sometimes you have to really dig deep and drill down to find the exceptions and make the connections. The main reason why the elderly and disabled chapter 33229 does not apply to this particular proposal is because that chapter is for housing that includes standalone units. In other words, it's a residential use outright, not a group living use, and each individual unit is self-contained. In other words, there's kitchen, bathroom, sleeping quarters, etc. There's no group dining facilities, no group accommodations in that sense. So that's why both staff and the hearings officer found that that chapter and its related regulations aren't applicable to this particular proposal. I think that Ms. Knight has done an exceptional job of going through the definitions and trying to find how it all works together, and I'll be the first to acknowledge sometimes going through those definitions can be a little bit tedious, and we also typically not only use the definitions, but we also go to the use categories and examine that language to make a determination. And I think, with all due respect to the appellant's arguments, I think one of the key issues here in the description of the use categories that frankly knocks the legs out from under the argument that this proposed structure is an SRO, single room occupancy only, is in the use category chapter at 33920.110. It describes household living, and once you go through that, the characteristics, the accessory uses, and the example, then there is section D that talks about exceptions, and the pertinent exception is at number 2. It says SROs that contain programs which include common dining are classified as group living. So in this instance, we do have, they're very similar characteristics between the group living use and an SRO in the fact that the occupancy, the individual, has sleeping quarters, may share bathroom facilities, but it's that group dining aspect, which would be common, if you will, in a number of examples of group living, such as a convent, such as a nursing home, or such as a group living use as this, where the intended residents, by and large, are going to be elderly, handicapped, although this type of use can also accept residents who are young and disabled. It's not strictly just for elderly. So does that help tease out the differences for you? Or?
Well, I'm just coming back to this is clearly a commercial enterprise. It's a for-profit business.
The hearings officer actually made findings in his report, and again, on pages 3 through 6, where he made a note that if, as he went through the code, if he determined it was a commercial use, that it was absolutely prohibited and it would not be approved. And then he stepped through the code, the definitions, and concluded that the proposal falls within the group living use category. Table 33110-1, which lists the primary uses allowed in single dwelling zones, includes group living, and the footnote says allowed through a conditional use if it's approved through those criteria.
Just seems, you know, it's come to a conclusion by going through all those steps that doesn't make sense just on the face of it. We've heard that this is a business that's, there's multiple different care facilities. I mean, do other assisted living facilities, are they classified as group living or as commercial?
The zoning code looks at these uses as group living. Obviously, there's going to be a business enterprise underpinning that use, but the code does not hang its hat, if you will, on the business end. It focuses on the group living use, and there are a number of these facilities throughout the city.
Can I just ask my colleague, because I'm puzzled by it. I understand the point, but I'm puzzled by it.
We fund for-profit and non-profit housing providers, for example. The code doesn't distinguish between whether it's a nonprofit or a for-profit. And our determination on funding looks to things like mission and outcomes and things like that. So when you use the word commercial, I'm trying to understand the significance of that in the context of someone's home or dwelling unit. And do you think that does the code in your judgment make that distinction?
Well, the code for the kind of housing you're talking about is often in the multifamily zones. It's not in the single family R7 residential zone.
I understand, but
the character of this use seems incompatible with the zone.
Except that it appears that the code specifically. I mean, and I appreciate Bonnie's close reading. She's the closest reader of code that I know, second only to Amanda Fritz. But I don't see anything in the hearing officer's report in terms of the interpretation of the code that undermines the conclusion reached by the hearing officer. It may strike us as being anomalous, but the specific reasoning offered by the hearing officer seems to follow the code, and I think we're bound by the code unless we change it.
And that, I think, it seems pretty clear that we do need to take a look at the code and do some refinement of it, so that to that extent this appeal is already successful and that it's been that's been made clear. I'm also wondering how big does a facility of this type get to be before we say that, no, that's clearly not a group home?
I think
doesn't he address that in his decision? I mean, he specifically addresses what kinds of uses are allowed in R7 zones.
Correct.
Related to this kind of facility, and he goes through the number of square feet allowed in various increments and the amount of people allowed, and actually this proposal is less than what the maximum amount of people would be allowed under
the
code.
Right. But what I'm wondering is if you have a big enough site, could you have...
But he addresses that in here and says there's a maximum amount. It would be allowed,
and in fairness to the applicant, that's not the case before us.
Right.
We're not setting precedent for.
But I mean, we're not doing something, you know, interpreting the code where there is no specific language to rely on. It specifically addresses the questions raised. And the question here is as to whether or not this fits into one of those definitions allowed in an R7 zone.
Mr. Lunder, would you allow me to call the question?
Please. I just have one more question before you do that, if you wouldn't mind. It's just a detail. How big is the required outdoor area on this site? And where is it located?
There is an outdoor area requirement. It is met. That's one of the development standards. We did a very thorough plan check. I can't pull the number right off the top of my head. It is listed in the
It's like 48 square feet per three residents, but I'm just wondering, Linda Bauer mentioned that the development standards don't necessarily have to be met at this point. But you did check to make sure that
yes.
development standard is met on the site plan?
And I'd like to, with all due respect, correct that. This proposal is subject to a number of development standards, not only of the base zone, but also of the group living chapter, which provides a ratio to add the extra density based on site size and a few other requirements in order to, again, help provide some built-in mitigation for these sorts of conditional uses in residential dwellings.
So that was actually my final point, and then I'll yield to Commissioner Fish. It seems to me that the intensity of this use and the scale of the building is such that it's out of character with the neighborhood. And I don't think that in fact, you could say that it's a cumulative impact of having the church and the fire station and then this much larger building than the adjacent residences. So I'm concerned about that, given the existing zoning, I don't feel that the approval criteria are met in terms of the intensity of the use, and the mitigation just doesn't seem, the arborvitae doesn't seem to cut it for me.
Mayor Adams, I seek recognition to bring a motion.
So recognized.
I would like to move the following motion, that the council uphold the hearing officer's decision, adopt the hearing officer's findings as the council's findings, and deny the appeal.
Second. Moved and seconded. Any additional discussion from council? Carla, would you please call the vote on the motion?
Fish?
I want to thank everyone who joined us this afternoon for this hearing, and I would say it's been highly informative, and I believe, speaking just as one commissioner, there's been a number of issues raised here that I will seek further clarification and advice from Bureau of Development Services and others, because I think issues raised by the appellant merit further consideration by the council. These issues do not come to us unless members of the community come before us in either the position as appellants or other contexts, and I appreciate very much the exchange, particularly with Bonnie McKnight today, and I thank her for her time. As always, we are the beneficiaries of terrific staff work in the presentation, and we thank you for that. And I appreciate the discussion with my colleagues, which I found very helpful in reaching a conclusion. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I do believe, I guess I appreciate the arguments of the appellants, but I think the hearing officer's reasoning as to why this is an allowed conditional use in the R7 zone seems very sound, if not a little complicated how you get there, but it seems to be sound. And, I would point out that adult foster homes that have five or fewer people in them are also commercial enterprises. I mean, they're in it, somebody's in it to make money. And I know we all sort of evoke a pejorative image of residential facility, but I think we need these. I think that we are, obviously we know we're an aging population. And frankly, as a former county commissioner who has toured adult foster homes with county inspectors, boy, there's a lot of room for improvement. There's some of those homes that I wouldn't wish upon my relatives, or myself. So I think this looks like a well-designed facility that will be well-staffed and provide an option for people. And I do think adequate. This does meet the relevant mitigations to fit into the neighborhood. So I also vote aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Fritz.
I appreciate the discussion. There's clearly a problem in the code, and that I agree with Commissioner Fish that needs to be fixed. I think the intensity and scale of this is out of proportion with the character of the R7 zone. I'm very concerned about the large institutional uses in neighborhoods that are far from services, that don't have sidewalks, that aren't near parks, and that these residents seem like they will be bound to the house, and that I'm concerned about the staffing that doesn't sound adequate. I realize that's not a zoning code issue, but it relates to the intensity of the use. The fact that the parking, the loading space has to be reduced, that there isn't room for the required size of loading space, seems to me that this site is attempting to have too much put on it. No.
Adams.
Thank you for the conversation, your research, the discussion, and my council's colleagues' consideration. I'm going to vote aye. So we now will take up, can you please read item 434?